Hello, Cinnabar Moths, any kind of moth you'd like to be. Welcome to the Writer's Triangle Cinnabar Moths podcast about all things publishing and books. Today we are here with Hector Duarte Jr., author of Icarus Over Collins. Hector, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Ross. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good myself. Thanks for asking. And thanks for coming on and talking with me.
No, thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it.
So I want to get into it. Are you feeling excited about the release of Icarus Over Collins that's coming out this upcoming Tuesday?
Yes, I am. Absolutely, 100%. It's a lot. It's a long process, and I really can't believe that it's actually going to make it out into the world in print for people to read. So I'm very, very stoked about that, 100%.
So you say it's been a long process. How long ago did you start writing Icarus Over Collins?
So that story is, so there's, not to give too much away, but the main plot element deals with, by the way, sorry, Ross, I think I'm going off script here. Can we curse on this podcast or no? Sorry.
Oh yeah, cursing is okay. Fine. Don't worry about that.
I just want to be sure, just in case there's a casual slip, but. So anyway, yeah, the incident of I was teaching at a high school in 2000, that had to happen in 2018, and there was actually a student who fell off a balcony like that. He was at a high rise in at his parents' apartment. He got locked out and he was trying to jump from the top floor to his floor. The balcony gave out and he actually fell to his death. He was young, 16. He turned 16 that day, actually. And I decided to write about it. But obviously I fictionalized it because writing about it from a nonfiction perspective, so to speak, would have been just sort of difficult. I just wanted to fictionalize it. So it had to have been, sorry, to answer your question, 2018 was when I really first started, like, the bones of the story. So that's what, 4 years, yeah. Four years, and then I think I turned in the draft to Cinnabar Moth like a year ago, maybe, or just under a year. So yeah, easily 4 years. 4 years is how long it took.
Okay. And so you started off with this nonfiction event that actually happened and then fictionalized it into Icarus Over Collins. When it came to writing this story, what was the process like over those 4 years or so?
So it's basically, you know, and I think this is true for any, you know, I had a writing professor at Florida International University that used to say, you know, nonfiction, I'm not going to name his name because after I say this quote, it might get him into trouble, but he used to say, you know, nonfiction is the art of things didn't quite happen this way, and fiction is things actually happen this way, right? So you hear that old adage, right? Things are stranger than fiction, or you can't write something that seems to. So the idea was, you know, in my fiction, at least, I can absolutely guarantee you that easily 70 to 80% of it is somewhat based on something that's happened to me or is happening to me at the moment, and then the rest is just me making it up. So that's sort of how that came about. You know, it's just a way of processing it, because obviously I've been teaching now. I'm a school teacher. That's what I do for full-time work. I've been teaching since 2006. So that's going on 16 years. Actually, yeah, 16 years. So in that time, I've seen, unfortunately, you know, a lot of great things mostly, but also a lot of tragedy, you know, and I've taught high school. So I've lost some students under tragic circumstances, you know, and that was one of them. That was one of those things where, and I said, okay, how do I, this is weird, you know, it's odd, it's very strange. How can I process this? And I just noticed I'm someone who, even though lately I've been flirting with more nonfiction, to me, fictionalizing something helps me process it, you know. So that's sort of where that came from. And then the rest of the story, those of you who read it, hopefully, fingers crossed, the one person who reads it, you're going to see that it obviously goes on a different, on a completely different track, where, you know, sort of the kid falling from the balcony, that death happens really early on. And then the rest of the plot is just basically it's just a revenge story, which is exactly what I set out to tell.
So did you go in with, you say it's the story you set out to tell. Is it, did you go in with the idea that you're going to write a revenge story from the very beginning, or is that something that developed later on during that process?
No, so I wrote the death scene, which is pretty much the first chapter. And then I said, okay, what is, and then, which is the weird thing, right? Because that's what I think all stories are. Cause, and I think that's where people make a big mistake. You say, oh, I have this great, you know, if you tell people you're a writer, you go to a bar, right? Kind of tell people, right. I tend to go to a bar, I have books or notebooks I'm writing. And I tell people I like to write, and they say, oh, I have a great story for you. And then they tell me their life story. But, you know, once you have that, okay, what's the story? You know what I mean? Like, that's, I think people think, because you can sit here and say, okay, a kid falls from a balcony on a Miami Beach high rise. Okay, then that's obviously a tragic story, but what's the story, I guess? And right. I hope I don't sound like, you know, like I have a, I don't know, like I'm jaded or anything, but I wrote that one chapter and I said, okay, now what? What happens now? Where is this going? Right? Because the kid's dead. Now what? What happens now? And that's where that story, that's where it turned into a sort of revenge story. I just wanted to see if I could write a very sort of basic revenge plot, which it's not. I'm not going to lie to you. It's not. It's kind of all over the place, if I'm being honest with you, from a writer's perspective. But I'm pretty happy with the end product for sure, because I think it's very experimental, and that's what I wanted to do.
Okay, so you had the core like event happen, but then from there you went, there needs to be more though.
Right, exactly. Absolutely, because, you know, a kid falling off a balcony or anything like that is a news story, right? So who, what, when, where, right. Why? And it's sort of, you know, it's great for that day, right? That's what news coverage is, like what's happening today. But if you want someone to sit there and be riveted, if you want someone to sit there for 2 hours and watch a movie, if you want someone to sit there for 3 days and read a novel, you need, or, you know, listen to a podcast, whatever the case is, you need to have something going to keep them coming back, keep them interested. And that's the very, very hard part of writing. You know, I I'm not trying to sound like a douche or anything, but I got my MFA in fiction and creative writing. So obviously one of the things I learned in at college was when you're writing, it's plotting, right? A lot of plot, like, okay, what's the story here? How do you keep, and that to me is the hardest part of writing. You know, characters are sort of, unique characters are sort of easy to write, you know. Sort of intriguing dialogue is easy, but it's that plot, okay? That what's the thing that's going to keep the viewer interested? And for me personally as a writer, that's the hardest part. And that's what I was trying to just sort of keep in mind as I wrote this.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense to me, because the plot is one of the key parts of that kind of engine for keeping everything moving forward, right? And without it, things fall apart very quickly. I think that some readers have preferences. You know, they'll say, I like connecting with these diverse, interesting characters, or I need an immersive dialogue, or I need the settings to be beautifully described. But at the end of the day, if the plot is extremely weak, it can lead to everything else falling apart.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I mean, look, a great example of that is Squid Game, right? Did you see Squid Game?
I have not. I've heard about it, but I haven't watched it.
You haven't? Okay, so, you know, if you watch it, or for anyone who's listening out there, it's basically, right, it's this kind of horrific game. It's sort of like a game show, but it, you know, people's lives are at stake is basically the plot, right? So that's the first sort of episode, right? And I was like, oh my God, there's these sort of crazy tests and competitions that people are put through. And they're pretty horrific, right? And that's sort of the intriguing, unique part of it. But what you need at the end of the day for that series to run, which it did, and to do it well, is a plot, right? And at the end of the day, the plot of that show is sort of a, well, by the end of it, is this sort of like, it's the individual characters and how are they going to get through this, right? Because horror and intrigue only last for so long, right? That's, it gets to a point where you got to give people more, right? And that to me is the challenging part of writing.
Yeah, the giving the people something to bond with and connect right. to keep them interested. So yeah. with that process with writing, would you say that it was painful or difficult for you to go from that, you know, the initial chapter into actually filling out the story and getting it completed?
So I wouldn't say painful. It was just very, so one of the things I did with this novella, I'm not going to call it a novel because there's no way it is one. If you look at the length, it's a novella. And I'm very happy for Cinnabar Moth for, you know, publishing it and going with it, because it is very experimental. One of the things I wanted to do was, and I did, is it's very much written in, it's English and Spanish. It's an English and Spanish hybrid. And what I did was I purposely didn't italicize. I didn't necessarily set the reader up for, hey, I'm going to be switching back and forth. I just did it. And I did it very, there's no warning. So like, there's no like, it's not, hey, one chapter's in English, one chapter's in Spanish. It's just sort of, it's in there. It's embedded in there, Spanish with the English. And that's what, growing up in Miami, a place like Miami, that's very much ingrained in me. I can, you know, I speak with my parents and I just switch it because there's, you know, I'm proficient in Spanish. I'm pretty good. But there's just some things, especially if I'm speaking with them and I'm talking fast, there's some things that I have to tell them in English just for clarity's sake. And that was one of the things I found myself doing. So I wrote the first chapter. For the most part, I want to say the first chapter is in English. But then I just kept writing and I said, you know what? Kind of. And this is where I'm going to start cursing. So I'm going to be honest with you. This is my first work. The first book I published was a short story collection, which was my graduate thesis for school for Florida International University. So it's very, if you look at it, it's very sort of, sorry, Ross, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Okay. No, because my computer's like warning me that it says people are having trouble hearing you, so I wasn't sure. okay, sorry about that. So, you know, that first short story collection is called Desperate Times Call. It's very sort of, you know, proper, and it was just me writing my graduate thesis and making sure I had, you know, characterization and plot, and I was hitting all of the elements that they wanted, that my graduate thesis advisor wanted. This novel was very much me kind of saying, like, fuck it, I just want to write. Like, I want to write what I want to write. I want to see where this goes. I want to not put too much emphasis on pre-planning. And that's exactly what I did. And part of me writing in Spanish was me doing that, you know, trying to capture Miami in a way that, I'm not going to say that it hasn't been captured before, because I don't want to make it sound like I'm trying to do something extraordinary, because it's not. But the idea of, to me, that language switching is very much a Miami thing. You know what I mean? That's how I grew up. It's how my friends do it, because I've heard them do it. And I hear people on the street every day, you know, just switching back and forth. And that was part of me doing that. You know, and I know, like, you know, people like Juno Diaz have done it before. And, you know, fine. I felt like all that stuff was kind of gobbled up and, you know, in the hype of the time. But I don't know. I felt like that was my best. It was the best way I could represent Miami. I don't know if that makes sense to me.
That does make sense to me. I think that something that is kind of not explored as much as it could be is that reality of living in a place that has multilingual people who just switch because it's natural to them. They, you know, you grew up with both English and Spanish, and so both of them fit with you and they're comfortable, but there are times when one is just more comfortable for the thing you're talking about than the other. And because the other person also speaks both languages, there's no reason not to. It just, it's natural for you to go between A and B and flow like that.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I definitely think that there's quite a few books out there that could have potentially been improved if people were willing to explore that and didn't feel necessarily trapped to the English language or trapped to Spanish, right? And so with going into that a little bit more with the kind of the growing up with being in a bilingual environment and tying that into the story, I know that's natural for you when you're speaking normally. Did you find it difficult at all to blend those together when you're writing it? Or did that also feel natural to you in terms of just your writing expressiveness?
It actually, if I'm being honest with you, it's funny because when I was writing it, so in the initial draft, it just came out, it flowed, and it was actually pretty good as far as it was me just doing what I do normally, which is just being able to switch English to Spanish. But I did find, like, in the revision process, I found myself worrying about, like, the accent more, or making sure that something was, you know, is this word correct? Even if a lot of it is like slang,
or right.
I tried to use some slang, but there's just some things where I found myself second guessing and saying, okay, should I use this here? Should I use this there? And then I'll be honest with you, I even used Google Translate quite a bit to try to figure out, because there were some scenes where I just kind of, it's weird. There were some parts where I'm like, I want this to be in Spanish, even if it was written in English, like in the first draft, a little vignette or a little scene. But I knew also that I wanted to make sure I got it right as far as the sensory detail, you know, the sort of smell, you know, the smell, the taste, whatever was happening at that moment. So initially, no, I just went with it in the first draft. But during the revision, which is, I think, normal for any writer, I definitely found myself sort of going over it a little bit more carefully, more like with a magnifying glass, and saying, okay, is this, and like worrying about my audience, which I hate, I freaking hate that I'm telling you this, but because that's part of the MFA indoctrination, right? It's this idea of, like, you know, make sure you're doing this, make sure you're doing that. They give you so many rules, Rasta. And then you realize that they're breaking, you know, writers break those rules all the time.
Yeah,
and
of course.
It's weird. It's weird when you realize that. But, you know, this was definitely my exercise in breaking some of those rules, but at the same time staying true to, because like we said before, you know, I do understand a lot of what listen, I'm forever grateful to the Florida International University MFA program, because when I started, I couldn't write myself out of a paper bag. Now I can at least, I feel, I can at least convey some sense of, I'm not going to say I'm good, but I'm better than I was when I started, you know? And so I definitely found myself carefully kind of going over, like I said before, just saying, okay, is this still accessible to, you know, my goal is to challenge readers, but, you know, at the end of the day, I still found that little voice whispering in my head saying, okay, make sure that certain people can read it. You know, and I hate to say it, but it's the truth, you know?
Mm. So. Yeah, I think that when that's hammered into you, it can be difficult to break away from it. I think also, there is, you know, some care that gets put into it, no matter who you are, to make sure that it can convey what you want to convey to someone who's reading it, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I think that type of process, personally, with having with my book that when I was writing it as well, I did sometimes think, is this something that people will connect to? Like, will this even make sense to somebody who isn't me?
Right. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, as a writer, you know, they kind of tell you, I guess, you know, the writer kind of, they write for themselves. But in reality, I mean, let's be honest, you want at least one other person. I mean, you want more, but realistically, you would want at least one other person out there to the stranger on the other side of the world to pick up your book and say, oh, I can connect with this, you know? Right. So you're always writing for someone else, you know? But at the same time, I'm the type of person, and maybe you feel it. I wonder, like, do you feel that too, where you're kind of like, you know, no, I just want to write for me. Do you ever feel like that defiant as a writer?
Yeah, there are sometimes, and I think, okay, but what if I didn't want to write that, the continuation of the story I wrote before, though?
Right.
What if I just want to do this other thing that popped into my head that's a cool idea? It's like, that I can't right now because I'm writing this story.
Exactly.
I definitely do get that sort of feeling of rebellion against it, or just wanting to give more, even though it's not actually giving more to the reader. It's just giving more of my ideas onto the page. Do you experience that where you have like these concepts that are really interesting and, you know, feel that they would flesh out the world that you're building or the story that you're building or these characters, but then you look at it and you go, actually, this is just slowing down the pace of the book.
Oh my God, listen, I constantly write, and you know, I'll start writing, and let's say I'm two pages in, and I know immediately, I'm like, this is not going to make it, but I just keep doing it because I know eventually, you know, there's, and that's something I learned again in grad school. I remember there was one time where I had been like, it was just, I was trying to write for my thesis. And I just remember I couldn't, I was just sitting there for hours, nothing would come out. I was trying to force sentences, nothing. And then the next day, it just came out, boom, 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 boom. I remember I mentioned that to a colleague of mine, you know, he told me, he goes, you know, the previous night gave way to the night after, you know, so you sitting there kind of beating your head and staring at a blank screen, not coming up with anything. It doesn't feel like it at the moment, but it eventually informs something. So even if you're sitting there and you're writing pages and pages, knowing this is not going to make it, it might not even make it for that story, but I promise you it's going to come up again. That's why I always keep everything in journals. If I'm writing something on Word, I make sure I save it. Even if I'm writing gibberish, because eventually I wonder if that's ever happened to you, Ross, but like, have you ever, because I noticed it happened to me in the revision process where I'll rewrite a sentence and I realize that I wrote the same exact sentence or the same exact plot line before without realizing. Like a line of dialogue, like I'll have a character say a line of dialogue to change it, and I realize that I had written it before. A very similar line before. Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah, I think there have been a couple of times where I went back and was like, well, what if I say it this way instead? And I think, I've said this before.
yeah, which is a great sign, because one of the things that I was taught was that once, you know, that your characters eventually speak to you, right? So that goes to show you that your character is speaking to you, you know exactly what they're going to say at any given moment. So that's the goal, right? Eventually. That's the goal that you want, the character speaking to you. So
it sounds like with the process of writing Icarus over Collins, you had this full opportunity that you gave yourself to explore things outside of the boundaries that you were taught in grad school. And really delve deeper into writing and have that discovery process for yourself as well as for the story style. And you came out with what I think personally is an enjoyable book to read.
Oh, thank you. I very much appreciate that. Thank you. Hopefully others will feel the same way.
And so you end up, you know, you finish writing a book, and the next step of that process is finding some place to get it published, right? So how did you end up discovering Cinnabar Moth Publishing?
Okay, so Cinnabar Moth came from, I had pitched this book left, right, and center. I was on Twitter at the time, and I was just kind of, you know, looking through pages and just even going online and finding, I have a book, it's called the, I can see it right now on my bookshelf, The Literary Marketplace. So I was using that, and I just kind of online indie publishers, and even big ones. And I was just, I was sitting there, I must have pitched, I'm not even kidding, hundreds of places, and most of them didn't even respond. Some of them did, and they were, you know, they would read the 10 pages or whatever they asked for. I think it's 25 to 30 pages, typically is the common amount. And they, I think just the language switching, they didn't dig it too much, you know? So I got your common sort of, oh, it's great, but we just don't think there's a home for it. You know, that tip, after a while, it's so rote and mechanical that you get discouraged. And then I did see a call for Cinnabar Moth publishing novels. This must have been like, it's been a year and a half, 2 years ago. And I said, well, you know, at that point I was just so, I said, let me just try it. I had nothing to lose. And boom, you know, figuring it was going to be a hard, you know. The good thing about hearing no so many times is that you develop a very thick skin. So after a while, you just like, all right, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's going to be another no. So once you hear that yes, it's like, you know, it tastes that much sweeter. And yeah, I got a response, and they were into it. So, and then even so, they were interested in the novel. And then I think Christopher asked me if I had any short stories, which I submitted, and they published those as well, which has been very nice. I gotta be honest with you, Cinnabar Moth has been, for me as a writer, has been very generous as far as publishing my stuff and accepting it. You know, that's rare these days. You know, so I'm very grateful and shocked.
So you discovered us through Twitter, and then you got the yes, but what made you end up decide to ultimately to publish with us instead of continue searching for a different home?
So just the fact that I didn't get, you know, I wasn't getting that rote mechanical response I mentioned before. It was very much sort of a unique, you know, response and a sort of warm embrace of this new, you know, of my story. And they weren't afraid of the language switching. There wasn't really much that they asked me to change, which I was appreciative of. You know, that helps very much. It was this freedom to just write, which is very refreshing. You know, there was no, I didn't get a lot of parameters set, and that to me, as a writer, as an artist, is great. It's very refreshing.
Thank you. It's nice to hear that we do attempt to let our authors, you know, explore their writing and embrace the fullness of writing as a whole. And it's great to hear that's being well received.
Yeah, keep it up, because I'll tell you, it makes a huge difference. It really does. It helps a writer's morale. It helps a writer's creativity, because you just feel appreciated, and it makes you, in my opinion, it makes you work that much harder and that much better.
Thank you. And so you mentioned before that you were you had your graduate thesis of short stories published previously, and then you've now gone through the publication process with us. What would you say has been kind of a surprising thing publishing with Cinnabar Moth?
So, like I said before, just the relaxed nature of it, you know, in terms of, you know, I didn't get, when I sent in my draft, I didn't get like a crazy, insane, copious amount of notes of, you know, change this, or our editors feel you need to do this. You know, it was, for the most part, there were some good edits and there were clean ones, which I pretty much wholeheartedly agreed with, but the crux of the story, the stuff that I really thought, okay, this is probably going to come back and maybe be a problem or have to change this, none of that was flagged or I wasn't asked to change it. So that was part of it, just sort of the ease and relaxed nature of publishing with you guys.
Okay, I'm happy to hear that. And yeah, with the process for books, we do tend to try and keep the story as whole as it can be in its original form and look more to refine the existing product rather than change the story that authors give us. Because, you know, it's your work too, and we want you to feel like it's still your book at the end of the process.
Yeah, that's very, again, you know, that's very important, and that's a good model to have, you know, because like I said before, it makes a huge difference, especially now that I really feel, you know, writers, I really feel that writers these days feel underappreciated, and you know, expectedly so, because it's just the market, it's tough. You know, it's tough. So you want to be with someone who's not going to ask you to compromise yourself too much, but still publish you, you know?
Yeah, that can be a difficult balance sometimes.
Yeah.
And so with the collection of short stories versus the process of publishing the book versus, you know, even the short stories that you've done with us, I imagine that process is a little bit different for publication for each of them. Has anything that's been particularly surprising or noteworthy to you during this publication process?
No, not so much. Nothing. I mean, well, I'll be honest with you. The thing that I do appreciate is, you know, like something like this, like this interview. Because I can tell you, the last publisher I had, their sort of promotion machine, quote unquote, or their promotion model was almost non-existent. So I do appreciate that even this is happening. You know, and it's something I'm not used to. So at first it was a little like, what, you know, what's a I know what a podcast is, like, what does that mean? Like, what's an interview? Because it wasn't, you know, that didn't really happen. It was just sort of like, all right, we've got your story, thank you very much. And then that was it. It was sort of like, you were forgotten, which in and of itself is a very weird. That was a very strange time in my life, because, you know, one of the things that the graduate program taught you was like, okay, publish. That's what you want, right? That's the dream. But, you know, publishing doesn't necessarily mean anything. You know, and again, I'm not trying to sound like sour grapes or anything, but they don't really prepare you for, okay, what happens when no one reads your work? What happens when no one's paying attention? You know, that can be its own weird process. So what Icarus Over Collins helped me do, and actually being with a house like Cinnabar Bar Moth, was just sort of relax and go into it just for the sake of its own, of the story, not necessarily the result. And I think that's what I've been working on in many facets of my life, not just publishing. Just doing the act for its own sake, as opposed to, okay, what's going to come of this? You know?
Yeah.
Not sure if that, I hope that makes sense.
It does, and I think that's a very, like, here, I've never gone through the writing school process, but I do think that just from my experiences of talking with other authors and kind of being on the publication side of things, there is a lot of stuff that just doesn't get talked about the realities of being on the other side of publication, or even going into the kind of machine of getting your book in, and then that entire process. I do think there's kind of that expectation of, you get published and then it's wonderful, your book's out there, people are gonna read it, and then, well, maybe not.
right, or just, you know, or even Rasta, like I was talking to one of my old MFA friends not too long ago. One of the things they, you know, the graduate program, the MFA program, was a great, you know, 4 years that I had of just being, I was in a bubble. You're in a bubble, and you're just writing, and you're creating, and you're workshopping, and you're with other writers, and blah, blah, blah. It was great. Okay, but what happens now when you have to go out and get a full-time job? And, you know, like, I have a child now. I can't, you know, sit down and write every day. This is not realistic for me, you know. A lot of my professors would tell you, oh, yeah, I sit down for 4 hours a day. I can't do that. Like, as much as I would want to, I would love to sit down and write for 4 hours. But I can't do it. I'm a father. I'm a full-time teacher. It's very unrealistic, you know. And one of the things that I, for any MFA programs, any MFA program leaders or deans that are listening to this, one of the biggest things I think they could use in MFA programs is financial literacy. Because one of the things they don't prepare you for is, okay, what do you have to do when you leave here now, and you can't write for 4 hours a day, and you're not in workshop, and you have to get a real job, you know? Right. They don't, you know, it's university is higher education is wonderful, especially graduate program. But in some ways, and this may sound controversial, but in some ways it's very unrealistic, because it's, like I said before, it's, you're in a bubble, you're researching, you're doing the thing you want to do constantly. But then now when you're spit out into the real world, and you have to find work, now what happens, you know? And I feel sometimes those programs don't train you for that shit, you know?
That definitely makes sense. And I do think that there is kind of that imbalance of, we're teaching you about this thing that you came to study for, but we're not expanding that to, when you make it through the other side, what your life is going to actually look like.
Right.
Absolutely. And I do think that that's a very common experience, even for undergraduate programs, of people going and, you know, getting their degrees, but then not knowing what to do with them on the other side of that.
Especially here now in the United States, here, ooh, it's a serious problem. And then guess what? Now you have this degree, you don't know what to do with it, and you're loaded with debt. You know, that's that's a tough situation to be in.
Definitely. And for you, you mentioned now that, you know, you went from your graduate program into, then you got work as a teacher, you have your relationship, and then you also now have a kid. That kind of, it's just adding on more things that kind of, they're good, they're positive things, but at the same time, that also means that there's more and more time being carved away from your ability to write.
Yeah. You're absolutely right now. Yeah. It's fine. I'm not like, you know, and you may edit this out, but you don't have to. You can leave it in if you want. I encourage you to. But like, I know we had some difficulty scheduling on my behalf, totally my fault, scheduling this interview. And some of it was, it's just, and I'm not bitter about it. You know, I'm a dad now. My kid is 19 months old. He's my first child. I'm having a great time watching him grow and just watching him, you know, hit his stride and his milestones. And yeah, I've had to put some stuff aside, which includes the writing, you know, and even reading. I haven't been able to sit down and read a book the way I used to in a long time. And I'm not upset about it at all. Because in the end, what I'm giving it up for is, you know, is him, you know, ultimately. And it's fine, you know. I wouldn't have it any other way, to be honest with you. But I do think, like I told you, you know, especially one of my professors, many of them, but my mentor sort of in the program was like, you know, you sit in the chair every day and they almost make you feel bad. I had to train myself, Rasta, to be honest with you, to not sit down every day and write and be okay with it, because it's this indoctrination that almost makes you feel bad, or you're not a true writer, you're not sitting down every day. And the truth is, some people can't do that, not without some sacrifices. Where, look, that same mentor, I'm going to give you a little anecdote, and I won't give you his name, but I remember this was very recent. I met up with him, and you know, I asked him, I said, "How did you?" He has one kid, but his kid's way older. But I asked him, I said, you know, how did you manage when your kid was just born, how did you manage to write? And I remember he said to me, daycare. he wasn't being sarcastic. I just didn't like that answer. That is not the answer I would have given. I'm not willing to put my kid in daycare and miss hours with him to write. You know what I mean? That's not a give and take that I'm willing to participate in, you know. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, you hear the stories all the time. Great artists, they tend to neglect other parts of their lives that are just as important, you know.
Yeah, I think that the kind of understanding your priority list and going, I love my kid, I'm not going to prioritize my writing over my kid and time with my child, is, I think that type of discussion probably doesn't really happen very much in the graduate programs.
Right. And it's, and you know, I'm, whatever, I don't know, it's tough to, I like to write, I think I'm okay at it, but I know I'm not going to write that great American novel. So to me, sacrificing time with, you know, with my boy, with my wife, to sit and carve out an extra 2 hours of writing, for me, that's an ego for me. Everyone else, you can do whatever you want. I get it. I understand, you know, that stereotype we have of the artist who just locks himself in a room for 8 hours, does their thing, and, you know, doesn't see natural light or whatever. But to me, for me, that would be ego. That's a little too much ego to have. Because I know I'm not going to write the great American novel. I know I'm not writing the next Oscar-winning screenplay. If I do, great. But I'm not going to necessarily sacrifice time with others to do it. You know, and that's... whether that makes me less of an artist, fine. But at this moment in my life, I'm not going to. You know? So sorry, to answer your question, Ross, I'm sorry. It was a long-winded... I try to write, and I just write whenever I can.
Yeah.
Whenever. If it's in the morning, if it's at night, if it's 30 minutes a day. Like the last time I wrote, I'm working on a piece now. I think it was maybe 2 days ago. And to be honest with you, I've been doing it for so long now. I guess that's the thing, too. I've been writing for so long now that I can just pick it up right where I left off. I don't need to write every day. You know how some people tell you, like, oh, I don't write every day, I forget. No, right. I can pretty much, you know, I can have a gap of 2-3 days, even a week, and if I reread the last paragraph I wrote, boom, I know exactly where to pick up, you know.
I think that's an important skill to have, because life does just hit you sometimes. Even if you don't have a kid, you don't have a spouse or anything, you might just have something that happens that takes up your time, and then if you can't pick it back up, that can lead to you just kind of leaving it to the side for a longer period of time. Being able to, you know, take a step back, come back to it is useful. And then beyond that, there's proof that you can still write even when you have all these other things that you're giving your time to, as evidenced by the fact that Icarus Over Collins did get written. It is done.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. Yeah, absolutely. And that was during, you know, it took some time, but yeah, it's absolutely done. And people do it every day. I mean, we hear, you know, every artist, you know, Quentin Tarantino has a family. Granted, he's in a different financial situation than I am, you can carve out. But, you know, all these artists have their time to do the thing that they do, and you can find them. It doesn't have to be in this construct of, oh, you know, you got to sit down for 4 hours at a time. And like you were saying before, I found that when I have a gap and I come back to the writing, it's actually that I'm more productive than if I'm forcing myself to try to sit down for hours at a time and do it, you know? Because I'm hating it. It's not natural.
Yeah, you know? I think that finding that flow for you is very important. And it seems like to me that you've found a flow that's comfortable for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it came with, you know, that's one of the things that I also like about Cinnabar Moth is the fact that it's very much, I was looking for an independent publisher for that very reason, because I wanted to go somewhere that would accept the writing for what it was and not necessarily try to sort of carve it out or weave it into something that they want. Does that make sense?
It definitely does. And I think I mentioned earlier that that's our goal, was to not do that and to let the author's story still be the author's story at the end. And hopefully you feel like Icarus Over Collins is still your story.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely.
And so pulling up on that with you've gone through this time, you've got your process that you've worked through, and you've put in the time and the energy to write and then rewrite and work to get Icarus Over Collins released. How do you plan on celebrating that? Do you have a plan for celebration of the release of Icarus Over Collins?
Well, that's a good question. I was not expecting it. No, not really. I'm glad it's done. I mean, maybe I'll, I don't know. Maybe I'll go out to dinner or something with my family, but nothing too crazy, no. No. I'm very weird with my writing. I'm very superstitious. So, like, I'm going to be honest with you. My family, only a select few members of my family know that it's even publishing. Until I have it in my hands or until it's out there, I don't like to tell people because I feel like it'll somehow jinx it. It's weird. I'm very superstitious when it comes to stuff like that.
I totally understand. There's that feeling of, if I talk about it now, it might ruin it. It's very fragile, kind of, in your mind. It's this fragile thing that you've crafted and taken the time to make. But if you just do one wrong thing, it falls over and the glass shatters.
Exactly. In my instance, it's so bad that, like, even if I know the books are shipping to my house, let's say, I won't say anything in case, like, you know, the shipment gets lost or something. Like, I have a feeling that if I tell someone, the shipment will get lost, or somehow the books will just disappear off the face of the earth. It's weird.
It'll be like a mass data wipe, and then all the data where it was saved is gone.
Exactly.
I can understand that tension that can come with that. But you mentioned that you've told a few members of your family about Icarus Over Collins publication. Are they excited about it?
Yeah, they are. They are. They are. They especially get very, because I haven't mentioned anything, they're sort of blindsided by it. Oh, why didn't you say anything? And my wife especially, like, my wife knows, but she's very much, she's always telling me, you know, why don't you tell more people? Why don't you? And I don't know. It's just, you know, they're excited, but they also know that I'm sort of, they're low key about it because they know that I'm a little weird about the way I do things.
You don't want to celebrate before it's actually done.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
It's not the best habit either. I mean, you got to be a little, you got to celebrate yourself a little. I do understand that. Maybe, you know, maybe I got to work on that.
Yeah, but I think that everybody has their own way of celebration. And if yours is just something low-key, like you go to dinner with your family afterwards and you go, hey, the book's out, woohoo. You have maybe a couple drinks and you go home. That's
yeah.
That's a perfectly reasonable and valid celebration to me. I've interviewed other authors who have said, all I'm going to do is have a day where I don't write. That's my celebration. Oh. It's just a day where I don't write anything. And I take time away from that.
That's actually a great way to celebrate. You know, not because it is, man. Writing is it's very taxing. Even if you sit there and you don't write, but just thinking about the stuff and thinking about, all right, how am I gonna complicate the plot, or how am I gonna? It's, you know, it's heavy. It takes a toll. You know, and then you have to go out and do whatever you do in your normal life. You know, so even if you're like a full-time writer, right? So like a Stephen King, or let's say you're the Duffer Brothers writing Stranger Things. I would imagine that in its own way, or even like a Quentin Tarantino, right? In its own way, it's probably a little bit harder because that's all you're doing all the time, 8 hours of that every day or whatever, 12 hours. I can't imagine. For me, you know, I carve out my time, and that's exhausting. I can't imagine sitting there every day and just processing my own story over and over. And then that's not even factoring in what the studio or the publisher is going to tell you. Because, you know, if you're like a Stephen King type, you know, the publishing company is going to have some notes. If you're a famous screenwriter, the production company is going to tell you something, most likely, you know, unless you're one of these Oscar-winning writers that has carte blanche. But even then, and that's got to be even harder, you know?
Because then there's even less direction in a way, right? And that can be, right. I think for some people, they flourish in that environment where it's like, yes, I can do whatever I wish within reason. And then other people are like, right. I prefer to have some direction for this because then I can fill it out in the space I've been given.
Right.
So I think different people can probably fit with different things with that. But I'm guessing from hearing you talk, you don't want writing to be a full-time career for you.
I mean, look, I'm going to be honest with you. I would love for that to happen. I would love for that to happen. It's why I went to grad school, why I spent so many years writing to this day. And this is going to sound, and I apologize to all your listeners, because I'm going to sound right now probably like a bummer. So, but I'm just being honest. I'm just being completely honest. I would love for that to happen. But the more time goes on, the older I get, the more realistic it becomes that it might not happen. So I've kind of given up on that dream. If it happens, great. I would do it in a heartbeat. Don't get me wrong. But right now, in the context of what my life is, and that I have to have a full-time job in order to write, then yeah, my priorities are just, they shift. The pie graph, you know what I mean, fills differently. Yeah. Obviously, I have to prioritize my work first, and then the writing gets done. I wish it could be the other way around, where it was just I'm writing and that's what I get paid for. That would be amazing, right? But it's not that way for me. It's not that way for a lot of people. You know, it's very unrealistic, you know, especially now. I feel like the market for it is just not there. You know, it's like I had a student one time tell me, and this was I'll never forget this, you know, we were just talking about like people who say they want to be football. I'm talking about American football, but you could apply this to any professional sport. You know, he was saying, yeah, because, you know, people say they want to be football players, but think about like the National Football League, the American National Football League. Think about how many players are in there. It's not a lot of people. Think about professional sports, right? Soccer, basketball, whatever it is. That's not a lot of people in comparison to the rest of the world playing that sport. It's a very small amount of people who actually make money doing that one thing, just like writing, right? So I would love to be a full-time writer, but right now it's not happening. So I'm just very realistic about where my place in the world of writing is, I guess.
Okay, so for you, it's more, it's not that you don't want it to become your career, just you're looking at it as, I'm not going to aim for that. If it happens, if it comes, I'll accept it, but from that's not what I'm going to be shooting for.
Exactly. And I'm especially not going to shoot for it if it means that I have to sacrifice right now the things that I prioritize. Look, at the end of the day, if I wanted to be a full-time writer, I'd have to put it first above everything. And I'm not willing to do that right now. I know that sounds terrible. I know that people out there maybe are listening and they're going to think I'm a hack, that I'm a shitty writer, whatever. Because that's part of that indoctrination, right? Our image of the artist is someone who sits there just all day and doesn't eat and ignores their wife or whatever. But I can't do that. I can't do that. That's not in my nature. And honestly, I think if I did it, my work would stop here.
I think too that that image is an unhealthy image to create and kind of an unhealthy thing for people to expect themselves to be, because then your life is sort of empty if that's all you're doing, right? Mind you,
I
some people
agree.
might be happy with that and that might be all they need, but I think a lot of people would prefer a fuller life, you know, having a wife that they actually spend time with, having a kid or kids that they spend time with, you know, having a partner, even if it's not a wife, a partner, somebody or other people and connections that they can spend time with and enjoy. And I think that people who only spend time writing and think that's what they have to do rather than what they want to do in order to move forward, those people will likely be a little bit less happy just because they're sacrificing so much for this potential thing.
Or you're less happy, or you're just oblivious, right? You get that stereotype of the sort of that artist that can't, or whatever, the image of Einstein who couldn't find his way home at the end of the day. Like, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be someone who's so engulfed in whatever they're doing that they're kind of missing everything else. That I guess maybe that's the best way to put it. I don't want to miss out on other things in my life right now, just because I feel like this story needs to get written right now. It doesn't. Are there things I want to write? Absolutely. But I know I will get to them eventually. I'm very blue collar about, maybe that's the best way to put it. I'm very blue collar about my writing. Like, I know that I will get to it, and when I get to it, it'll get it done,
I think that's a perfectly fine way of doing it, and I think that having that representation out there as someone who finds time around the rest of their life to do it, and it's something they do on the side, and they enjoy it as it is also important for people to see and for people to understand is an option and is realistic, right? And because I personally don't agree with the image that everybody who wants to become a writer has to sacrifice everything else in their life to do it, because I don't think that's true. I think that some people can. Who do that will make it, some people who do that won't, and also people who don't do that can make it, and people who don't do that also might not make it as writers. And it's really not that straightforward.
Exactly. And then, the worst thing that could happen to me, and maybe that's part of it, what I wouldn't want to, I would love to become a full-time writer, but what I don't ever want to happen is for writing to stop being fun. And if writing became a job, oh, then I wouldn't want to do it. And that to me would be the ultimate failure, because I genuinely love to sit and write. I love the process of it. But if it was ever sort of like I felt like I was punching a time clock, oh, I think that's what Kurt Cobain said, mentioning Freddie Mercury, with Freddie Mercury, that he felt like he was punching a time clock towards the end of his. I would never, never want to feel that with writing, because then I feel like I failed. That to me would be the ultimate failure in my art, is if I felt like it was just work,
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. And on with the process currently, you know, you're enjoying writing and you've got Icarus of a Collins coming out now, and it's happening this upcoming Tuesday. And I imagine that's exciting. But something else that I'm think might also be exciting is the knowledge that A. Christopher Collins is going to be listed in the U.S. Library of Congress. Is that exciting?
Yeah. I had heard that, and I'll tell you, it's shocking, actually. And when I say that, I mean it in the best possible way, because that to me is just ridiculously shocking. But yes, it's very exciting for me because it's just there. You know what I mean? It's like an imprint. And that's just amazing. I mean, what more? That's the reason you write. That's the reason you do any kind of art, is to just exist, even if you're just a little blip for just a small moment. And that to me is something that is just amazing. You know, I'm just flabbergasted to hear you say that. So yes, very exciting.
And with that, there's that knowledge that your book is kind of immortalized in a way that wouldn't otherwise be, right? Because it's in libraries.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like I said, it's just my name. And again, not to sound too grandiose or anything, but just the fact that that's going to be there. Mm-hmm. Like I said, imprinted forever is pretty amazing. That's crazy.
And so it's like one of multiple steps for a book, after publication and everything. It goes out into the world, it finds places to be, right? And some books find more places, some books find less. But if Icarus Over Collins were to find its place, for example, amongst the bestsellers and be a bestseller, what would you do with that? How would that feel?
I think I'm going to be honest with you. I'm just speaking plainly because I'm not trying to sound any more than what I am. I'd be very surprised, shocked. I think I'd have a hard time believing it, to be honest with you. But if it did, then that'd be great, because, it means that, we're not, that people are ready to read, and they're ready to read something challenging. And again, I'm not trying to make my book sound like Ulysses or like a James Joyce text. It's not. It's a very simple read. It's a very simple story that I set out to write. It is very, like I said before, very experimental. But just the fact that it's something that switches languages, I'm very proud of that. The fact that I wrote that, I like the language that I use, which is not like straight, sort of like, I would hope that, some people, I'm sure they will, but when they read it, especially people from Miami, I hope they'll read it and be like, oh yeah, I can hear that, like right now. That's what I set out to do. So if that's, I didn't necessarily want to capture the glamour of South Beach, or the, because that's already been done, and it's been done to death. What I wanted to capture more than anything was the language of Miami, which I feel is not just English, it's not just Spanish, right? But it's a hybrid of all of those things and many other languages that are spoken here. And just the real day-to-day things that occur, and the grittiness of it too. Miami's a very, I think internationally it's seen it. The problem is that with Miami, I think a lot of people immediately go to South Beach. And South Beach is a very, very small, tiny sliver of an island that doesn't even really belong to Miami. But what the city of Miami is and its suburbs is a lot more than that. And it's a lot of it can be gritty, It really can be. And I think that doesn't get captured as much. Even though Moonlight did it. Did you see the movie Moonlight by any chance?
What was that?
Did you see the film Moonlight?
I have not.
That is a very good, if you get the chance, Moonlight, it's called. It's very, I think it won the Oscar 4 years ago. But that, it's set in Miami, filmed in Miami, and that movie very much captured, like, sort of the inner city, what it's like growing up here, and not necessarily in, the glamour that people think of when they think of Miami. Because it's that's a very small part of it, you know?
Okay. So for you, that Moonlight captures that aspect of Miami, and you're hoping that Icarus Over Collins, or you feel that Icarus Over Collins captures something similar, where it's a like more overarching experience of Miami rather than a specific location's part of Miami.
I'm not gonna say I feel it does. I'm gonna say I hope it does, because yes, that was definitely my intention. Absolutely, I was trying to capture more of the aesthetic of what I feel Miami is.
And so with that kind of idea of, you know, it connects with a lot of people enjoy it and it becomes a bestseller, and we expand that even further. Let's say it goes to a movie or TV series. Like, you get a deal for one of those. Do you have a preference if you imagined Icarus Over Collins getting that offer, if between movie or TV?
Yeah, well, if it did, that would be awesome. But I think definitely just because of the type of story it is, it would work better as a movie than a TV series. Because it's not... I mean, unless somebody was able to, I think a movie would be enough to capture the entire story.
That makes sense to me. It's also kind of on the shorter side for a TV show experience, right?
Yeah. Unless you did like a limited series, but even then, I think it's too. Yeah, I think a movie would just do it. Yeah.
So if we imagine that were to become a movie, do you think that you'd want to have a lot of creative control over the movie adaptation of Icarus Over Collins?
Oh man, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I dream of doing is writing screenplays. Like, I kind of flirt. I have a couple screenplays I'm working on sort of now. They got shelved because I just had one workshop and it was ripped to shit, but so that's fine. But yeah, I would love to adapt into a movie if someone's willing to do it, or just to write a screenplay eventually. That is definitely one of my ultimate goals, for sure.
And so let's imagine, you know, you've gone through that process, right? You got picked up for the movie deal, you went in, you participated in the screenplay creation, and now it's set to premiere. If that happened, would you want to go to the premiere, and who would you take with you?
Oh my God. So easy. Absolutely 100%. I would go to the premiere, and my wife and kid would be right there, right next to me, for sure.
I think that's wonderful. It's a wonderful image to have as well, right? And with all of this, this movie, TV show talk and bestseller talk and everything, that naturally comes with its own form of fame, right? Your name getting out there, people knowing who you are. What is your relationship with fame? Would you want to be as famous as someone like Stephen King, where you lost your anonymity?
No, I'm... So, Stephen King fame, wow. I would... So, let me see if I can phrase this correctly. I wouldn't want the type of fame where I lose my anonymity, but I would like the type of fame where I could just etch out, which we talked about before, etch out a picture. If I could just make my living off writing, that'd be the truth, right? And where my writing was consistently picked up. So for example, even if my name wasn't well known, but just like I was a screenwriter and studios, you know, filmed my script, that would be awesome. You could keep all the awards, you could keep all the infamy or the fame, as long as I could just write and tell the stories I want to tell, and they were published or filmed or whatever, archived, let's say, that would be great, and I can make a living off it. But as far as losing my anonymity, no, because I'm very uncomfortable with that. I'm not, I mean, listen, let's be honest, Ross, again, this may be a controversial statement, but I really believe that all artists, and you know, people can tell you the opposite, but I really believe even 5% of every artist, you want to be known. That's why you do what you do, right? I think some part of you wants to be recognized or immortalized in some way. So there's a little bit of ego in it. But, you know, so of course, do I want to be recognized for good work? Yes. Do I want to lose my anonymity or have everything I say be scrutinized? No. No. I'm very uncomfortable with that. Because then what happens is it's a vortex and other people get sucked in. Because now I live a life where it's not just me, right? I have a wife, I have a kid. So there's a huge responsibility that comes with that. And I wouldn't want them to be sucked into that vortex, you know?
You'd prefer kind of that balance of you're known enough that people go, I know Hector's work. It's great. Of course, I'm interested in seeing more of it. But they're not going, I wonder what he did last Saturday at 2 p.m. Did somebody check him in on him? Let's see what he's been doing. What's his family doing?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. That's exactly. So, yeah, it would be like, I would want to be known by, like, maybe, like, let's say I was a screenwriter, but like a film aficionado, right? Like, oh, have you watched this? Kind of like, you know, maybe every once in a while an Oscar nomination would be great, but not that you know me so well that, like, you close your eyes and you can see an image of me. You know what I mean? Not that type of thing.
Right.
No. Yeah. Because that comes with its own set of responsibilities that I think I don't want to handle.
No, that totally makes sense to me. I definitely have kind of the same feeling about it where I wouldn't want to become super famous just because I enjoy my privacy and I enjoy kind of the ease, the mental ease, the psychological ease of not worrying about how much I'm being looked at.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it comes, and listen, man, people are mean too, because you're going to be looked at, not going to be looked at for different things. And then, like I said before, then somehow they get a picture of your wife or your kid, and then they become potentially targets for being made. And that I wouldn't be able to handle. Like,
right.
Me, you can say whatever you want about me, and I could care less. But, or couldn't care less, whatever the term is. But I know someone's going to pick that apart. But, you know, you say something about my wife or child, and I know I'm going to say something inappropriate. And then, of course, being famous, you're going to get it. Now I'm going to have an even bigger spotlight on me. You know, and that to me is difficult. You know, I have a very thick skin when it comes to me. When it comes to my family, that's, I don't know if I'd be able to stay quiet, you know?
I totally understand. You're protective of the people you care about.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do think that becoming famous can make it difficult to give them the same level of protection just because you're exposed to more people and more people have this kind of, it's not true insight into your life, but they do look at you a lot and people judge when they look. It's a natural thing that happens. But when you're famous, it's a lot more people looking, a lot more people judging, and a lot more people talking about it.
Yeah. And feeling, and taking ownership. You know, like feeling that they know who you are and have a right to, you know, especially now in 2022, man, fame is not, you know, what it used to be. And I don't even know if it ever was what we thought it was, but that sort of old Hollywood kind of glamorous type of, I don't know, lifestyle. I don't think it's, you know, I was reading an article where, Quentin Tarantino said that all these Marvel movies, that what it's doing is, so his argument was that there's no more movie stars, that it's the characters who are the famous people. So like Chris Evans, for example, plays Captain America. People don't love Chris Evans. They love Captain America, right? So this idea of like, we're not necessarily in love with the actors. We're more in love with who they're, the heroes that they're playing, the comic book characters that they're playing. And I definitely think that now in 2022, that's what we're, you know, focused on. I don't think we like actors and actresses. I think it's just the characters that they play, you know, and there's a difference.
Yeah, I agree. There's definitely been a shift more, I think, towards selling the characters and selling the universe that it's set in. But I do think still some people still connect very closely to those actors. You know, like when you imagine Captain America, you imagine Chris Evans.
Right, right. Yeah, when you imagine, that's a good point.
When you imagine, you know, Tony Stark, Iron Man, who do you think of?
Yeah, Robert Downey Jr., yeah.
I think it kind of has a combination of the two where, in a sense, they become synonymous.
Right. Yeah. And, but I wonder if the actor wants that, you know?
Yeah, I don't actually know if that... I think some of them might enjoy it and some of them don't. I think that's probably
right.
Down to the person. I hadn't really... It's something that I'm aware of, kind of as a side thing, but it's so distant from me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm sure the check helps a lot. The checks that they get,
yeah, for sure. you might care a little bit less as Iron Man selling tickets when you're, you know, you can afford a very luxurious and comfortable lifestyle from it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the last Avengers movie didn't. I think it hit a billion. I don't know what the exact figure is, but it went into a billion. That to me is ridiculous amounts of money. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's crazy.
And so, Hector, I'd like to thank you for, you know, taking the time to talk with me today and for being on the Writers Triangle. It's been a pleasure having you on.
No, thank you, Rossman. I had a great time. I just realized I said Rossman. You probably get that a lot. But yes, I had a great time. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time, you know, to ask me these questions, to have these conversations. And, you know, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks, Cinnabar Moff, too. And it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure working with you and talking with you. And to all of our Cinnabar, our beautiful Cinnabar Moths, or whatever moth you'd like to be, thank you for listening. Be sure to check out and to buy Igris Over Collins coming up this upcoming Tuesday. And Hector, real quick, can you tell everybody listening where we can find you for social media and such?
I actually, to be honest with you, I just got off of Twitter because of the whole Elon Musk thing. For now, I'm not really anywhere. Sorry. I know that's not great for a sales or anything, but yeah, I'm trying to get on Mastodon, so we'll see. I'll let you know soon if I join it, if they approve me. But for right now, I'm not really on anything. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, so for everybody listening, be sure to visit cinnabarmoth.com where you can check out the transcripts, and we'll have updated links for Hector's social media whenever that gets sorted out. For now, though, thank you all for listening, and thank you again, Hector, for coming on and talking with me.
No, thank you, Ross. I appreciate it.
And to everybody listening, bye-bye.